It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Sandra Smith.
I'm Trey Gowdy.
I'm Shannon Bream, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, March 21st, 2023. I'm Dave Anthony. Federal Reserve policymakers meet today and may again raise interest rates tomorrow.
We've seen in the past where inflation begins to rise and it can't be stopped. The genie is difficult to stuff the genie back in the bottle. So they're trying to nip it before it really goes crazy.
We speak with Republican Senator Bill Cassidy.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Tension with one of our critical trading partners is increasing, and Mexico's president has some angry words for Republicans who want to go after drug cartels as President Biden shifts on some border policies.
You have to devise mechanisms whereby you can protect people on both sides of the border who are collaborating, and that protection needs to come from political will at the very top.
And I'm Dr. Mark Siegel. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Lately, when there's a Federal Reserve meeting, like the one that starts today, the big focus is on inflation and further interest rate hikes to lower prices. But this time, there's another concern.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen at a Senate Finance Committee hearing after two banks failed, Silicon Valley and Signature. And there is still concern about other regional banks, which the Fed will be considering before making an interest rate decision tomorrow.
The Biden administration has been pumping money into the economy long after it was necessary for the COVID crisis. It's triggered inflation.
Republican Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, who got into it with Secretary Yellen at that hearing, which we'll play for you a little later.
The Fed is rapidly raising interest rates to try and tame inflation, and these banks are caught.
Okay, so explain how they're caught, because, you know, these are very complicated transactions and what banks do. So what caused Silicon Valley and Signature to fail?
Well, I think there's two different issues there.
All right.
So let's focus on Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
They got a certain amount of money they got to put aside. They usually put it in investments to help address future obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an obligation may be somebody who has their money deposited in the bank deciding to withdraw the money.
Right.
Their investments only had an interest rate returning to the bank of like 1, 2, and 3%. Now, as interest rates rose, as the Federal Reserve increased the amount, the borrowing cost, if you will, I'm going to lose this bet.
Yeah.
He's going to pull out his money. And people begin to pull out their money, and they had inadequate reserves.
And all right, so that one goes away. What happens with Signature Bank?
Signature Bank was heavily invested in crypto. Now, crypto has just kind of imploded recently. Not all crypto, but some crypto.
Yeah.
And so if you're heavily exposed to one aspect of the economy and the economy goes down, then you're in trouble. In Silicon Valley, it was the tech sector. In the case of Signature, it was crypto. As an example, we've seen this before. That's what's kind of frustrating. So anytime you have a bank which is focused only on one industry without diversity, they're in trouble, potentially.
The purchase of the assets of Signature Bank by New York Community Bank, how important is that? Do you think that that can help with just any concern about the banking industry? Obviously, the Treasury Secretary told your committee last week the banking system is sound.
Well, the Fed and other FDIC are trying to manage this, FDIC, by saying, okay, if a bank's in trouble, we don't care about the investors in the bank, but we do care about the depositors in the bank. So let's reassure the depositors. If your bank's in trouble, we're going to rescue. We, the Fed or FDIC, is going to make sure that you get your money back.
Even if you have uninsured deposits, right?
Apparently, even if you have uninsured, and that's kind of the controversy. But for most people, they got far less than $250,000 in a bank.
Yeah.
So if you got over $250,000, you may have an issue. But if you have under $250,000, you're okay. And it's going to be as seamless as possible because we'll bring another bank in to otherwise manage the operations. Because, of course, banks don't just pay interest on a savings account. They make loans. They're managing your mortgage for you. They're helping you with your car note. So if you're in the middle of a car note sort of thing, then they can help you get through that. So they're trying to make it as smooth as possible. And we don't know how successful they'll be until we know the underlying strength of the bank economy.
Now, the U.S. government is saying, look, this is not a taxpayer bailout of these depositors, that they were using the money for the uninsured out of fees that banks are already paying. Do you think that's the right move?
Well, I think it's the right move. It's a little deceiving because we the depositors, will pay a little bit extra fee, which, of course, will be passed on to us. So there is some exposure to the depositor. But that said, technically, they're right. There's no tax dollars obligated, and I think that's good.
You have said that the Fed is trying to raise rates. They have been doing that, obviously, aggressively for a while to try to tamp down inflation. Do you think that they've been doing the right thing trying to do that?
Well, they're kind of caught between two tough places. Inflation's been going crazy. And we've seen in the past where inflation begins to rise and it can't be stopped. The genie is difficult to stuff the genie back in the bottle. So they're trying to nip it before it really goes crazy. Now, by the way, we can see that they're having to work against this administration. The Biden administration continues to pump money into the economy where clearly it's not necessary to pump money into the economy. Or if it's necessary, it's only in the eye of the beholder, not in the eye of the general person. One example, their continued pause on student loan repayment is effectively pumping $5 billion a month into the economy.
The student loan payments were paused because of COVID. They're still paused now. Now, the president's in the middle of a court fight. He wants to have $10,000 to $20,000 in student loan debts for some people wiped off the books entirely. Do you side with those in court trying to stop the president on that?
I do. First, it's unconstitutional. He is effectively trying to allocate federal dollars, and the Constitution says that that shall be done by Congress, and in particular, the House of Representatives. So it appears to be unconstitutional. He's taken a law, by the way, that was initially meant to apply to people going to the first Iraq war, and he's expanding it to millions. Secondly, it's an issue of fairness. Somebody that sacrificed to pay off her student loans, you know, didn't take a vacation, lived in a less expensive home, worked two jobs. She pays back her note, but somebody who decides not to gets off scot-free. Literally, they get off scot-free. I mean, why are we doing this? By the way, the president doesn't address the underlying issue. There are still going to be people who are 18 years old being preyed upon by institutions of higher education who want that student to take on a massive debt so that the institution of higher education gets all the money. There's still a need for transparency. I've got a bill for transparency, but there's still going to be students effectively getting ripped off.
All right, back to that Senate hearing last week. It also focused on President Biden's budget plan. And Senator Cassidy got into it with Treasury Secretary Yellen over the future of Social Security.
The president knows many people on Social Security.
Then why doesn't the president care?
He cares very deeply.
Then where is his plan?
He stands ready to work with Congress.
That's a lie.
And then after Senator Cassidy explained, they get nowhere trying to set up a meeting with him, Yellen reiterated.
Well, I believe the president does stand ready to work
well, again,
with
empirically, that is not
address.
True.
And he told Yellen she is not being told the truth.
I don't mean to be rude, but since I've had multiple requests on a bipartisan basis to meet with him and he's turned everyone down, that rings hollow.
My colleague's out of time.
That's Democratic Committee Chair Senator Ron Wyden, who admonished Cassidy.
Accusing witnesses of lying.
But I did not accuse her.
And then his time really was up. Days removed from that, Senator Cassidy says the clock is ticking on this issue.
Social Security is going broke in 9 years. That's the Congressional Budget Office saying this. It's been predicted for 30. We know it's happening because of high inflation. It sped it up a little bit. So in 9 years, under current law, somebody who's depending upon Social Security for her retirement is going to get a 24% cut in the amount she gets. That's under current law. The president's budget does nothing to address that. He's proposing $4.5 trillion in tax increases and has not a dime for Social Security. Now, I've been trying to engage with him. Other senators have tried to engage with him. You can't meet with the guy. Oh, you can meet with staff. They string you along. But you can't meet with the guy that's got to make the decision. And, by the way, what I learned last week from Janet Yellen is that they have not at all looked at any proposal by which to address Social Security.
All right.
So people are going to get 24% cut, and he didn't care.
Well, the president has said that he's going to make sure Social Security is stable. He claims Republicans want to cut Social Security, and he says that his budget will make Medicare solvent for years to come with his tax increases. Medicare is also, over the next maybe 5 years, going to be in trouble financially, correct?
It is going to be in trouble. So let's go back to the president's approach. He wants to address the debt and deficit, so he's going to raise taxes on those over making over $400,000. He's going to take care of Medicare, so he's going to raise taxes on those making over $400,000. And he's going to take care of Social Security, so he's going to raise taxes on those over $400,000. He's got one reflex. The president should have more of a plan than a single phrase he repeats over and over again, like a parrot who's learned one thing. You got to do more than parrot. You got to have a plan. So far, I've not really seen the president has a serious plan on anything.
Senator, what would you like to do with Social Security? What do you want to compromise with him on, if you can?
One thing that we've been working on, a bipartisan group of senators and talking to people in the House, is let's do with Social Security what we do with almost every other well-funded pension plan. Let's create a separate fund and allow that money to be invested in something besides treasuries. You can put it in real estate. You can put it in stock market. You can put it in a couple other things so that as the economy grows, this money grows too.
Some might argue, well, what if there's a stock market collapse and all of a sudden you had that money in the stock market and you've lost a ton?
You know, it's interesting. Well, first, we would hold it in escrow for a period of time to allow there to be a return on the return. But if you start in 1929 and every 20-year period since, 1929 to 49, 1930 to 1950, et cetera, the average return in the stock market has been 8.5%.
Okay.
Now, that's with the Depression. That's with the Great Financial Crisis. That's with this. That's with that.
So that's with all the ups and downs averaged out.
It's been 8.9%. And someone said you could even invest at the high point and then go down to the low point. But over time, you still end up much better than the treasuries. And by the way, the risk would not be borne by the individual. The risk would be borne by the fund. So the individual is always going to get the amount she's been promised. It won't. We'll stop that 25% decrease. It's 24% decrease that's going to happen now under current law.
Maybe you'll get a meeting with the president?
If the president is serious, I don't think he's serious. In the State of the Union, he made it clear that he wants to use Social Security as a wedge issue to get reelected. What I'm trying to do is say, wait a second, rise above your reelection politics, do your job that you were elected to, take on the issues that are important to the American people, and one of them is to make sure that a retiree living paycheck to paycheck does not get a 24% cut because you've chosen to do nothing.
Republican Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Dave. Thank you, man.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
This is Dr. Mark Siegel with your Fox News commentary coming right up.
After four Americans were kidnapped and two of them were killed earlier this month, purportedly by a Mexican drug cartel, some Republicans in Congress called for a new label for cartels, terrorist organizations.
We're going to unleash the fury and might of the United States against these cartels. We're going to destroy their business model and their lifestyle because our national security and the security of the United States as a whole depends on us taking decisive action.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said that after speaking to the South Carolina families of the Americans who were kidnapped in Matamoros, Mexico. Others agree with Graham, but are a bit more circumspect when it comes to the label.
The one reason I worry about doing that is just because it could potentially create a massive legal asylum case for millions of people and make our immigration crisis worse. So one of my bills just designates them as transnational criminal cartels.
Texas Republicans Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw talked to Fox News radio host Guy Benson last week. Since October 1st, Customs and Border Protection officials say 69 people caught at the border have names that match those on the terror screening database. This year, three American women from a town near McAllen, Texas, who went to a flea market in the state of Nuevo León, have disappeared. And the FBI is now offering a $20,000 reward to help find Maria del Carmen Lopez, a dual citizen of Mexico and the U.S. who was kidnapped in the state of Colima. The State Department's urged Americans for months now not to travel to six particular Mexican states, including Colima. State also issued a special travel warning for spring breakers, urging particular caution in the downtown areas of Cancun, Playa del Carmen, and Tulum. But even for some who stay stateside in a place like South Padre Island, a day trip to Mexico would normally be on the table.
We're going to go to Mexico for like a day or two, like something cool to do. And then, yeah, we heard about all that. We're like, maybe it's not the best idea to go to Mexico right now.
They didn't want me to come, but I told them I had to do some convincing, but it's a little bit nerve-wracking, to be honest.
Mexico's president is responding to the tension with harsh words of his own, as the country to our south remains our number one trading partner.
Well, I think Mexico is attractive because it has a nice climate, it has nice beaches, and it's a short flight.
Earl Anthony Wayne was U.S. ambassador to Mexico during the Obama administration and is now co-chair of the Mexico Institute Advisory Board at the Wilson Center.
We, you know, now have more than 20 years of many people going certainly to the Yucatan Peninsula, to Cancun in that area, and then in the recent last 10 or 15 years going to the West Coast to Cabo San Lucas and Puerto Vallarta. And they're very nice places to go for a vacation. So I think that attractiveness of them is still there. The violence is located particularly in about six states in Mexico. And those are the most dangerous states. And they're the ones where people are urged by the State Department not to travel. And that's sadly where those four Americans went who crossed from Texas over to Matamoros. That has long been a violent state. In the time that I was there, we had a number of kidnappings of Americans, both citizens and residents, going across the state, one way or the other, for vacations or visiting families. It's just a state with a lot of gangs and a lot of violence. And so the key thing to remember is to really read the State Department's travel warnings and abide by what it says.
After four Americans were kidnapped and two were killed in Matamoros across the border from Brownsville, as you noted, the Gulf cartel wrote a letter apparently apologizing, saying some of their guys acted outside of the cartel's authority and left those men bound on the street for authorities to pick up, which was certainly notable. But this whole incident prompted some lawmakers to say that, you know, that this incident, others like it, at least certainly missing Americans, combined with the fentanyl crisis, means it is time to designate cartels as terrorist organizations. And of course, mentally, right, the leap then gets made to, you know, an image of U.S. troops marching into Mexico. But some Republicans say that it doesn't have to mean that. It could mean going after finances, gathering intelligence. There are a number of things short of marching into Mexico. How do you see it, this conversation?
Well, I think what the incident with the four Americans did was call attention back to how dangerous parts of Mexico are. They also pointed out that we really have been having a crisis with the amounts of fentanyl coming across the border heading north, and that those flows have apparently been increasing over the past couple of years, if you judge by the seizures at the southwest border. And that ties into, of course, the focus that people have had worried about the number of migrants coming across those borders. They sort of all converged here. And I think what it reminded many people is that we have not had the closest cooperation with Mexico in these efforts to fight crime. And they're very protective of what they see as their sovereignty. They are worried about having too much cooperation, especially in Mexico with U.S. law enforcement agencies. So all of this was bubbling there below the surface when this happened. And I think in one sense, it's very healthy that now people are looking at where it's safe, where it's not safe.
The president of Mexico, to your point, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, otherwise known as AMLO, has said a number of things in response to this conversation we're having about Mexico, like we're not going to allow any foreign government or foreign armed forces in our territory. And if Republicans keep calling for a terrorist designation, he said he'll start a campaign to encourage all Latinos in the U.S. to not vote for Republicans. But he also said that fentanyl is not produced in Mexico en masse, and that the U.S. has such a drug problem because we don't hug our kids enough and let them live at home long enough. Is this a president uninterested in tackling the cartel problem, or is he just being defensive here more broadly to your earlier point about, you know, engagement with foreign governments?
Well, one, I think he is being defensive. And he does have a long-held suspicion of having too close cooperation, especially in Mexico, or too much presence of U.S. law enforcement in Mexico. Mm. Secondly, I think a number of the things he said can be fact-checked very successfully. let's say I was in contact with a journalist fairly recently who wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal where he visited one of these fentanyl labs in Mexico, and I think he had a few pictures in his story. And a number of U.S. reports prepared by our law enforcement agencies and our Bureau of International Law Enforcement Narcotics have said to the knowledge and information that they have, there is fentanyl being produced in Mexico. And in fact, the Mexican Army put out a press release a couple of months ago noting that they had gone into a place where the pills were being put together and seized a very large number of pills with fentanyl in them. Mm-hmm.
So they're aware.
I think this is part of trying to not have all the blame go to Mexico, and I understand that. And it is true that the United States shares part of the responsibility for this very serious problem. We do need to help reduce demand in the United States for these drugs.
Of course.
We need to have better care for our people who seem to be sensitive to addiction, who get addicted to the drugs being available. You can't just solve this through enforcement. But if you get demand reduction, you aren't going to solve it either unless you have enforcement actions. And that means enforcement in the United States, at the border, and in close cooperation with Mexico.
Well, but to that cooperation point, you know, Congressman Dan Crenshaw of Texas said this is a president in Mexico who's in the pocket of the cartels. That's obviously a big statement. I wonder if we would even know if he was in the pocket of the cartels. We didn't know, apparently, for some time that Mexico's public security secretary, Garcia Luna, was taking bribes from cartels and at the same time was taking security money from us. He was convicted this year of drug trafficking that was alleged to have happened between 2006 and 2012. Would we even know? How deep might this problem run, this connection between the government and cartels? And do we have a handle on that?
I would not say we have a sufficient handle on knowing how deep the penetration by the cartels is in Mexico. It has been a serious problem, as you just pointed out, for a long time, you know, at least 15 years or so, and longer than that in some ways. And we do not have a complete understanding of that. I'm sure our law enforcement intelligence agencies are trying hard to pick up that information, but it's not easy to obtain. And I think that it's true that what the two countries have to do to work more closely together is find a means for having better ways of having vetting on the officials on both sides that are collaborating. You have to have trust if you're going to work together in law enforcement operations. You can't have sensitive information leaking out to people who have been either intimidated or bought off or both. So you have to devise mechanisms whereby you can protect people on both sides of the border who are collaborating. And that protection needs to come from political will at the very top and needs to be built and then start producing results.
Former Ambassador, finally, what do you make of this president's recent shifts on the border? You were ambassador during a different time, during a Democratic administration, but an administration that handled the border very differently than this one. What is your sense of this administration's handling of the border from having sort of very maybe little in the way of enforcement and so many people coming in to these newer rules or these updates, if you will, that seemingly came just this year recently?
Well, I think that migration needs to be handled by a mix of strong enforcement and reforms and improvement to our migration system. And you have to have both of those. If you just lean to one side or the other, you're not going to be able to make progress and not going to respect the humanity of those many people that are coming that are good people to you, but maybe on the move because of bad things happening in their own country. And so I think we are now moving back toward a position where we're going to be balancing those things. And the additional element that I wish we could get to was a serious bipartisan discussion of migration reform, of our law and our system, and of funding all the different elements of it. And then recognizing that it's not going to be solved by just Mexico and the United States either. Many, many of these people now coming across the border are coming from a wider range of countries, sometimes dictatorships like Venezuela or Cuba, Nicaragua, fleeing, you know, the inability to support themselves in their own country. So we have to have the help of other partners. We have to build those partnerships. But it needs all of these. It needs all of these elements to succeed.
Former Ambassador to Mexico, Tony Wayne, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to speak with you.
New from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for season 3 of my limited time podcast, Everything Will Be Okay, based on my best-selling book of the same name. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Dr. Mark Siegel.
What's on your mind?
A teenager I know very well is heading south to the beaches for spring break this week, equipped with a toothbrush, clothes, condoms, and something new, a Narcan inhaler. This is not for himself, but because he worries about others in case he comes upon someone who isn't breathing. He read the instructions carefully, but knows there is no downside to spraying Narcan or naloxone in an unresponsive person's nose, just as the Panama City police know there is no downside to cameras and sniffing canines on the beach, just as throughout Florida, nonprofit groups, including the Pinellas County Opioid Task Force, Florida Harm Reduction Collective, and Recovery Epicenter Foundation, all distribute Narcan to businesses and potential victims. Narcan can reverse an opioid overdose, but it wears off quickly, whereas fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times more powerful than heroin, can last for days. This means repeated doses are needed, and in the hospital, an intravenous naloxone drip. Unfortunately, drug overdose deaths continue to rise, over 100,000 per year, with the vast majority from fentanyl. Narcan is available in many places, including pharmacy chains over the counter, but we need increased awareness and distribution. There's no doubt about it. What is going wrong? Why is this year different? Why am I, as a physician, worried? For one thing, our precious teens are sadder. In fact, a recent survey from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention revealed that almost 60% of teen girls have reported an episode of profound sadness over the past year. Now, I am concerned that this will translate to recklessness as depressed teens try to liberate themselves from their negative feelings by partying on the beach. They may be more likely to flex their social muscles as an expression of freedom that the pandemic is now over. The problem is the risks, especially with the drug cartels flooding our country with synthetic opioids, advertising on social media, paying people to bring their product across the border, advertising at high schools and colleges to lure students to come down to the border for a small fee to pick the drugs up and distribute them. The numbers are staggering. The Drug Enforcement Administration confiscated close to 400 million potentially lethal fentanyl pills, 2 milligrams or more per pill, last year alone. But there are many times that amount that escaped DEA detection, and fentanyl is often disguised in a fake Xanax or Adderall or oxycodone pill so that the teen doesn't know what they're getting. And before they know it, they are subject to the strong effects of fentanyl. Spring break has been around in the U.S. since the 1930s. but it is not what it used to be. Not with the State Department issuing a travel advisory to six Mexican states. This continued warning has to do with drugs as well as kidnappings and killings. Unfortunately, the problem is not limited to Mexico alone. It stretches across our southern coastlines to where our teens are gathering. Most of all, we need to talk to our teens. We need to do our best to connect in a meaningful way prior to their departure. Our teens are going to travel to spring break, no matter what we say, but we still have a role to play to warn and to guide them. In New York, Dr. Mark Siegel, Fox News.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.